the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's dirt in Australia, but it's often owned by a foreign power or even a pension fund. We're talking about who owns Australia's farms today. The Weekly Times published an annual report looking at just that. Of the 10 biggest, one country is five of the largest investors in Australian agriculture. It's Canada. Does Canadian investment in Australian agriculture matter as much to you as all of the debate, all of the discussion, all of the interest we had when we were talking about Chinese investment in Australian agriculture a couple of years ago? Chinese investment's been replaced by Canadian investment, largely looking at the numbers, and we're going to go through them together today on the program. Does that matter in the same way to you? It's certainly not reported in the same way, is it? Wonder what you make of that. You can join us on the Country Hour today, 1300 303 46. No, 1300 977 222 is my number. I keep getting it wrong. 1300 977 222 to call me on the Country Hour. You can text as well, 0467 842 722. James Wagstaff from the Weekly Times is going to join you about that shortly. You'll also hear from Chris Bowen today, Federal Energy Minister, as you've just heard in news, making major announcements about offshore wind in Gippsland. What does that mean for transmission lines? He will tell you that. We'll hear from Port Ferry fishermen. And up next, we're going to talk about wine, because despite the Chinese market reopening for Australian wine, the industry still wants assistance.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Yeah, the wine industry renewing calls for federal government support as budget time approaches. The industry wants an $86 million package to support unprofitable growers to transition out of wine grapes. It wants the government to pay grape growers to pull out their vines. And they want help to find new international markets for Australian wine as well. Currently, there is a significant oversupply of cheap wine around the world. And the price Australian growers are receiving for their grapes has plummeted, despite more wine going to China in the last 3 weeks than has done for the 3 years prior. It's still a difficult time for the industry. Anthony Catanzariti, wine and grapes sourcing director at Treasury Wine Estates, one of the biggest companies in Australian wine, says the industry has been through tough times before, but what it's experiencing right now is different.
It's been a really tough 3 or 4 years for the Australian wine industry, and in particular our inland supply regions of, you know, the Riverina, the Riverland, and Murray Darling on Swan Hill. And it's really been driven by a number of different factors. You know, it's been pretty obvious with the China trade challenges that we've faced over the last couple of years with the really high tariffs that have been imposed. But on top of that, there's a global oversupply of commercial wine. So that's wine sort of sold below $10. And that's right across every sort of continent, South America, South Africa, and through Europe. And so Australia is just adding into that as a region that's struggling right now. Also, the cost structures change. So a lot of your listeners would understand that, you know, the cost to grow any agricultural crop has gone up significantly over the last couple of years. And the problem with wine is that the pricing on the retail space isn't moving up. So it's really quite challenging in that entry-level space.
So when you get out and about on the road and talk to your growers, what are they telling you about those challenges and what sorts of decisions it's making them contemplate?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, a pretty consistent message, especially across our inland commercial wine regions. You know, these guys have had a significant decrease in their returns. You know, grape pricing has dropped back by more than half over the last 3 or 4 years, and at the same time, input costs are going up quite considerably. And this is why Treasury is sort of voicing, you know, our support for the recent announcement from the industry bodies, you know, requesting the government at this time, at budget time, getting in and having a look at a support package to assist some of these growers. And these growers are going to need different assistance, whether they are wanting to stay in the industry and how they can get more efficient, or in some instances, there are some growers who want to exit the industry and are looking for a a seamless way out, I suppose, because right now it's a lot of these guys are just losing money growing grapes due to the market conditions.
So as you've touched on there, the industry sort of banded together and they've put in this call or this submission with the federal budget looming, asking for, I think, $86 million for a bunch of things. But as you mentioned there, one of those being to help growers transition out of wine grapes. But when you've got perhaps a small farm, permanent planting of grapes, how difficult is that to just try and switch out of grapes and do something different? And how long is it going to be before you're going to have money coming in again?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question, Angus. Look, in some instances, there's not a lot of other crops for these growers to transition out of. All horticulture is sort of struggling right now. I think, you know, with the cost of living crisis, everyone's struggling to get their heads above water. So in some instances, the support packages are just about removing the grapes. Because it's quite an expensive exercise once you start pulling vineyards out, removing, you know, posts and wire and plastic grip tube, etc. So, you know, some of it's just leaving the land vacant or fallow, and potentially selling that land or allowing these growers to remain in their houses without having to lose money, I suppose, year on year growing grapes that they can't sell or have to sell it below the cost of production.
You're also, or the industry is also, wanting the government to play a role in sourcing new export markets, I suppose, diversifying places that Australian wine ends up. I mean, has some of that already happened during that period when the Chinese tariff was in place on Australian wine?
I think the wheels were in motion. I think right now, you know, we've got a clear path forward in China. I'm hoping we've got a clear path forward in China to get Australian wine back on the shelf. But at the same time, I think we need to get people on the ground in some of these other developing countries to start promoting and showing some parts, especially around Southeast Asia, what Australian wine is about, and assisting with the opening up of those markets for, you know, with free trade agreements, but also knowledge on the ground about Australian wine and how we can get wine into different retail opportunities.
But ultimately, though, there is going to be a contraction, a reduction in the amount of wine grapes grown in Australia?
I think that's a key part of what the industry submission support package really gets to the nuts and bolts of, is that we, you know, there is a global oversupply of wine. There is a change in consumer preference as well. So we're seeing consumers move to more light and fresh styles of wine, or moving up the quality scale and up the pricing scale, which is leaving this bulk wine or commercial wine surplus at the bottom end. So in Australia, so we can be, I suppose, sustainable going forward, there has to be some reduction in the amount of fruit in the ground. And what that number is, no one really knows. But without a change and without a change to the supply base, I think, you know, these issues will continue into the future.
Not sure if it's possible to answer this, but what happens if, come the federal budget, the government ignores this request for a support package? There is no money forthcoming.
Something needs to change, Angus. So if this support package isn't picked up by the government for this budget, I think we will be working as an industry to try to work out next steps. But I think it's a really pertinent to why Treasury is sort of putting itself out there and speaking on behalf of the regions and these communities, that something does need to change, and our voice, you know, adding to industry bodies and AGW, Australian Grape and Wine, we think it's important, and hopefully it's heard.
That is Anthony Catanzariti there, Wine and Grape Sourcing Director at Treasury Wine Estate, speaking with Angus Verley. And in a statement, the Federal Agriculture Minister Murray Watt provided to Angus, it says, and I quote, "We received that letter from the Australian Grape and Wine Sector Representative Body last week. We thank them for their ongoing respectful engagement on this issue. Whilst it's not possible to fund every proposal or good idea in the budget, the government listens respectfully to ideas put forward in the lead up to the budget each year. The Albanese government is delivering practical support to grape and wine growers, such as the Farm Household Allowance Program and concessional loans through the Regional Investment Corporation. End quote. Many of your texts coming in on this and on who owns Australian farmland. Michael, though, in Albury goes, why do farmers, this time grape growers, expect ordinary taxpayers to bail them out for their bad business decisions? Michael, look, there are multiple arguments either way on that. I suppose the certain theory of economics says, that's their business decision, they have to wear that. Other theories would be it's government's decisions that made the China market be lost for so many years to Australian wine growers. It was working fine until geopolitics got involved, and that is the main reason their industry has been hurt so hard over recent years. I don't have the answer to that, though, but they would be the arguments either way. 0467 842 722 if you would like to send us a text. On foreign investment, which we're about to talk to, Canadians, huge investors in Australian agriculture right now. This says, I was re-foreign investment in farmland. I would prefer no foreign investment. Canadian investment is more acceptable than Chinese investment. One is a democratic country. The other is a communist country. This makes a significant difference. Also, how each country conducts itself in international matters. China likes to flex its muscle. Canada barely makes a ripple in world affairs, says Tony. Another one says, Canadian investment in farms is different to China. Investment because Australians can go and buy a Canadian farm. We're not allowed to go and buy a Chinese farm. And the ANZ Bank owns most of our farms, Warwick, says Grumpy Farmer Jim. I suppose there is always that argument too, right, Jim? 0467 842 722. Do you care who owns our farms? Is this important? And does Canadian investment hit differently to Chinese investment? That is part of the debate that comes out when we talk about the annual list that looks at who owns Australian agriculture, which we'll do right now. Canadian pension funds dominate that landscape. That includes high-profile billionaires, foreign investment, and a partnership that owns two Switzerlands worth of land. The Weekly Times have published their annual look at who owns Australian farms. Editor James Wagstaff is the curator of that list. He can join you now to talk about it. James, welcome. How do you describe what this report is? Because you've been doing it a while.
Well, thanks for having me. We started it about 8 years ago, I think, when S. Kidman & Co., there was that whole brouhaha about S. Kidman & Co. being sold to offshore interests. I think the Chinese were swooping at that time ahead of Gina and her Chinese partner kind of actually sealing the deal. So we kind of took a bit of a step back and thought, you know, this is an issue that's really playing out in the mainstream media, and it's only worth about $300 to $400 million at the time, which what it was. And we discovered that, you know, some of these overseas pension funds had huge portfolios worth significantly more, that, and they were kind of flying under the radar a bit. So we kind of started digging about, you know, into who's actually owning this farmland. You know, we came across some really interesting stats on overseas websites of, you know, overseas pension funds, and they revealed the data of what they owned in Australia. And it kind of really snowballed from there. The first couple of years, I look back on it and think it was a pretty sad old investigation into who owns Australia's farm. But we've really been able to dig deep and get some really good info together. And, you know, it's probably the centerpiece of this whole investigation is this huge list that we keep updating every year that's, you know, now 1,300, 1,400 properties deep. And it just shows, you know, the different trends, the different ownership structures. They're all operate under different ownership structures. That's probably one of the most interesting things I've found. But, just the level of investment in Australian ag at the moment is quite significant.
That's one of the difficult things, isn't it? There's no easy list to go to for this information. You've had to create it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. No, and we did. And, you know, as we've seen, you know, 8 years ago there was not a lot of information publicly available on websites. What we're seeing now, I think, and this has kind of been partly attributed to the fact that, you know, these big pastoral companies, these big investors are crying out for jobs. So they're providing more publicly available information. They've created websites, you know, and a lot of that information now is available on websites and stuff like that. It's just a matter of piecing it all together and then obviously going back year by year and making the changes and working out where the trends are. But in that time, you know, you've popped up another 10 pastoral companies that have kind of popped up on your radar too that you didn't really know about. So
1,400 properties on your list at the moment, well, sort of even aggregations in a lot of ways. A handful of those own the bulk of the properties, don't they? A handful of investors.
Yeah, it's just quite interesting. You know, you look at obviously PSP Investments, which is, you know, we've spoken about in the past and we'll continue to speak about in the future. They've come in totally under the radar in the past probably 5 to 7 years, and they've got like $7.5 billion worth of assets now. But if you look at their name on the list, they've got a huge number of different entities that they're involved in, and a huge number of properties. Like Altura Ag, which is their cropping arm, has got something like 60 to 70 properties just itself up there in the Riverina. They've gone into Victoria, you know, WA as well. There's the Aurora Dairies, which have bought up quite significant chunks of Victoria, Gippsland, and into that southwest Victoria area as well. Just a list of them, because we name it by property name. So, you know, once you do a line for each property, it kind of runs for pages.
And when you start looking at the overall picture, who does own Australia's farms? Who, what type of investor are the largest owners?
Yeah, well, we kind of split it into two different facets, I suppose. We look at investors by value and then obviously the biggest landholders by size. So, you know, obviously PSP, which have come in quite heavily.
So that's, you know, the Canadian mounted pension fund.
Yeah. So the pension fund for the Canadian Public Service and the likes of the, you know, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which is quite good for a headline at the Weekly Times. But it's so they've got $7.5 billion worth of assets. I remember doing this story initially and they had $3 billion, and you know, it's just grown exponentially over the past couple of years. Macquarie Ag, which is you know, the likes of Paraway Pastoral Company, they've got about $4 billion of assets. They're an Australian based fund, but does include some overseas capital as well. It's interesting, the top 10 kind of investors by value all include some form of overseas investment. So Tear Creffett, number 3, so that's Nuveen Natural Capital. They're from the US. They're a New York-based teacher superannuation fund. They've got about $2.5 billion of assets. Then it goes into the likes of CK Life Sciences from Hong Kong, Rural Funds Group, a couple of ASX-listed entities there, Rural Funds Group, Australian AACo. Obviously, they're 200 years this year, you know, a bit of a standard bearer on the Australian farming landscape. But, interesting, out of the 10 biggest investors by value, 5 of them are Canadians, which I find really interesting. Yeah. And then, obviously, on the landholder front, we've got, you know, some of those bigger pastoral companies in central and northern Australia.
I'll go into the size kings in a minute. But just in terms of the ownership by value, why are Canadian pension funds such big players in Australian ag? As you say, 5 of the top 10.
Yeah, 5 of the top 10, and you don't really hear much about them. It'd be a different story if they're all Chinese, wouldn't it? So obviously PSP has been, heavily on the scene for quite some time. There's Fiera Como, which have now come out. They've kind of been – they were set up by, I think, some former employees of PSP. They've got about $1.2 billion of assets, particularly in that Western Victoria, Southeast South Australia end, but also to a larger extent in WA as well. They're making a bit of a play over there. Manulife, which is also a Canadian-based fund, it's got about 1.2. Austin, which has got some significant horticultural assets there in the Goulburn Valley, they've got about similar amount, 1.2. And then there's Alberta Management Investment Corporation from Canada as well, which has invested, quite strongly recently in the Kimberley area, and they've got about $1 billion. So I think, getting back to your question, the reason Canadians are coming, it's a pretty similar investment landscape to what they're used to back home. Obviously, they can get scale out here, which is one thing that they're lacking over there. You know, but our parliamentary systems are similar. We operate, we're a part of the Commonwealth, and it's seen as a kind of safe haven for their funds.
And you made the comment that it would be, we'd be talking about this differently if it was Chinese investors. Why do, I suppose, culturally and in news services? Why is Canadian money more accepted and almost a non-story compared to Chinese investment in Australian ag?
Well, I think it is. It is that obviously not a communist nation. It's considered, you know, similar to Australia, I suppose, in many respects. As for those points I mentioned before about being part of the Commonwealth, about having a Westminster parliamentary system, you know, it's pretty similar. We've got a similar kind of outlook on life. Obviously, the Chinese, you know, we do any story at the Weekly Times on a property sale, and I can almost guarantee every time we post it on Facebook or social media, there'll be a comment at the bottom saying, please don't sell these to the Chinese. And in fact, the Chinese make up a very small proportion of investment, current investment now. They've still got quite a large stakehold in parts of Northern Australia in particular. But, you know, when you look at it more broadly, they're not the ones coming in spending the money at the moment.
And then that's the money side of things in terms of the value in Australian agriculture and the value in the holdings, because not all land is created equal. There are the size kings as well, those who own more land than others. How does that break down in Australian ag?
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting. So obviously Jana Reinhart was, you know, billionaire Jana Reinhart was at the top of the list there for quite a number of years. But in the past, I think the past 3 years, it's been a bit of we've seen a bit of changing of the guard, kind of two Central Australian, I'd say, mates. That's how we refer to them in our publications and in our coverage of this issue. But Viv Oldfield and Donnie Costello, they run Crown Point Pastoral Company. And, you know, together these guys have got, you know, something like 9 million hectares of land. So that's huge there. So they're number one by a long way too. So AACo is sitting in about that 6.62 million hectares. We've got the North Australian Pastoral Company, which is backed by the Queensland Investment Corporation. So that's about 6 million hectares. And then it's a lot of families too. The Williams Cattle Company up in South Australia. We've got the Hughes Pastoral Family from Queensland based. But the things like Macquarie Agriculture as well, obviously in there with Paraway being such a significant $4.5 million player. And then you've got the likes of Gina, but it is like those northern holdings, the McDonald family, Consolidated Pastoral Company, the Brook family from the Birdsville, you know, from the Channel Country. It's all quite significant players.
And it is interesting in how, as you've pointed out, this has changed over time. The talk when you started doing this was Chinese investment in Australian agriculture. And then a big story was Gina Reinhart's investment in Australian agriculture. Neither of those are the major players in the list as it stands today. So it goes to show you how quickly things can change.
Yeah, exactly. And whether it swings back that way or not, it'll be interesting to tell. But yeah, no, during the time I've been doing it, it's just the North American money that's come in is quite interesting to watch. But also a lot from Europe as well, stuff like that. But, a fair bit of money out of the Netherlands. I think, you know, they're big backers of some of our bigger farming investors. Yeah, but it's just been that absence of Chinese or the withdrawal of Chinese money. I think they received a lot of loans from their government in a period of about 5 or 6 years ago, and that's what kind of drove a lot of investment in Australian ag. You know, Australian ag is difficult environment to invest in long term because, you know, obviously we've got the varying seasons, we've got droughts, we've got floods, and, you know, that can knock you around. So people, you know, quite often take their money and run. But, you know, certainly these North American funds seem to take more a longer term approach to agriculture, and they're investing for the long term.
James Wagstaff, it's been good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Woz.
Editor of the Weekly Times, curator of the Who Owns Australia's Farms list, James Wagstaff. Speaking to you there, many texts coming in regards to this as well. Chris says, "Hi Warwick, our government should not be allowing any foreign investment in our agricultural land or even domestic housing." Brian says, "Knowing some of the Chinese-owned farms are terrible farmers. If it wasn't for the very good workers on these farms, there'd be in a heap of trouble with some of the husbandry practices. Should not be allowed to buy anything in Australia unless it's reciprocal," says Brian. And I suppose in terms of examples of that, you've seen some of the sales in recent times of Woolnorth Dairy, which is being shrunk considerably and having a lot of animals killed off after losing contracts and so forth at the moment, Brian. But interesting thoughts all the same. 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text here on the Country Hour. After the news, we'll head offshore, actually, but we'll talk wind energy generation offshore of Gippsland. And we'll also talk about what Port Ferry fishermen are up to at farmers markets these days. But right now, let's get some rural news with Jane McNaughton. Hi, Jane.
Good afternoon, Woz. The vegetable industry is warning that workforce shortages are looming again as a major issue for food producers across Australia. That's because there are further changes ahead for the popular Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, or PALM scheme. From the 1st of July, employers need to guarantee 30 hours of work a week for these seasonal workers for the duration of their stay. Lucy Gregg from AusDeVeg says there are implications of other changes to visas.
We've seen quite a trend towards utilising backpackers, certainly now that there's more in the country. We did an industry sentiment survey back in January, and that showed a 20% decline in growers utilising PALM scheme. So where our concern lies is if they start making changes to the working holiday maker visas and things like that, which certainly been mentioned, and with the migration review currently underway, it's something that we'll be lobbying for to make sure we still have access to the backpackers.
Because if they do remove that caveat where backpackers have to work 80 days, that could spell the end of that workforce and be disastrous for food producers right across the country.
In drought-stricken Western Australia, a Margaret River trucking company that sells and ships feed to farmers says their stocks could run out in 6 weeks as drought conditions continue to grip the south of the state. Glen Bay Hay Transport has been trucking feed right across the southwest for 40 years. Owner Anna Noakes says demand is at an all-time high with surplus feed almost exhausted.
Insanely busy, very high demand. We only had this once before, which I think was about 2010-11.
How much hay are you delivering on a weekly basis to people?
About 20 to 25 loads, feed double loads of 40 tonne, 38 tonne. People have just exhausted their own hay supplies. It was a dry winter, and so consequently a lot of farmers were down on hay to start with. That market has dried up. We cannot find any more hay now, hay or straw for that matter. It's just not out there.
The New South Wales government has announced a discount program that will make $1 electric identification tags, or EIDs, available to sheep and goat farmers. It will ensure that EID tags are available to producers to assist sheep and goat farmers as they transition to mandatory EID tags from the 1st of January 2025. New South Wales Minister for Agriculture, Tara Moriarty, made the announcement earlier today.
The New South Wales government will support farmers with a significant discount for electronic tag pricing for the first year of this program. The discount will be 76 cents per tag, which will bring the cost per tag down to $1 a tag. This is a really significant discount, and it's something that farmers have been asking me for since I've been the minister, and I'm really pleased to be able to deliver this discount for them. $1 a tag for the first year of implementation will make the process a lot easier for farmers.
A new training program in South Australia is helping to attract more people to working in the prawn industry. The program was co-designed in Port Lincoln between prawn skipper and Australian Maritime and Fisheries Academic Lecturer Peter Sturman, the Spencer Gulf and West Coast Prawn Association, and Local Jobs Northwest Country, and has seen many of the participants offered immediate jobs. It allowed them to see the industry in a more hands-on way on the boat, instead of just heading straight out to sea to work at night, which is the common practice with prawn fishing. Kylie Graham from Australian Women in Fishing, and also now a prawn fisher, was one of the participants offered the job.
So it came down, had a look and ran through it, went out on the boat. We learnt so much through the course that you felt comfortable to be able to go out at night. Mind you, nothing prepares you for that first drop when the sun set and everything's dark and there's stuff going everywhere, and it's just, you've got prawns all over the place, you've got crabs, and yeah, it's a really hectic environment. And it's step by step teaching you how to grade prawns, how to sort prawns, how to pack prawns. With the training, you get on and you have a sense of ease about what you're about to partake in.
And areas of northern Australia are reporting an above average wet season. On the WANT border, Ruby Plains manager Jenny Griggs says there had been more than double the average wet season rainfall.
So we've had over 1,000 millimetres for this wet season, so that's probably from October through to now. So usually we have about 18 inches, so that's our average.
You're more than double.
It's been,
you're going from a 440 mil average to 1,000 mils this season.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So, yeah, but we're pretty lucky. It's been fairly spread out. Grass is sort of just starting to, like, it's getting too much. It's like it gets too sour when it gets too wet, sort of thing. So, but it was spread out enough that, you know, it didn't really stuff it all together. So,
and that's today's rural news.
Gotta love those wet season rainfall figures, don't you? Oh, 1,000 millimetres off the average of 440. Whew, there's some kind of numbers. We'll take, well, much less than that, anything on the weather forecast. In fact, we're about to go to that. A couple of your texts before we go there. We've been speaking foreign investment on the program today. Five of the top 10 largest Australian agricultural investors, Canadian pension funds, which is really interesting in itself. A lot of themes coming out of that discussion earlier today. This is interesting, though, from Michelle in South Gippsland. Hi, Warwick. As an expat Canadian now farming in Australia, I wonder what the significant Canadian investment in Australia says about the opportunity for ag growth in Canada. It's interesting in itself, and it's certainly huge in terms of numbers. Larger investment from Canadian pension funds than our own super funds in Australian agriculture, which is interesting in itself. And we were asking, do we care as much about Canadian investment as say, China? Because when China was ahead of that numbers, it was the biggest story in Australia. Now it's barely rates a message. And, well, many of you wanting to talk about Chinese investment in Australian ag, even though it's declining on our text line right now, which is interesting in itself, right? You can keep those thoughts coming. 0467 842 722 is the number to text, or 1300 977 222 to call me and have a chat about it. Right now, though, let's find out what's happening weather-wise. Stephanie Miles can tell us, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau. G'day, Stephanie.
Good afternoon, Warwick. How are you?
Yeah, you don't have wet season rainfall figures for us, but we'll take just about anything on the forecast at the moment. How's it looking around Victoria?
At the moment, right now, across the state on the satellite imagery, it looks like it's quite a nice settled day at the moment. We do have some lingering showers over Gippsland and our southern coast, but otherwise there's a bit of cloud building in the south and it looks like there's a lot of sunshine in the north. So looking relatively settled around the state at the moment. I cannot give you any rainfall figures, particularly for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, and is it more of the same for the rest of the week, or what
more
are we looking at now?
More of the same. Yeah, look, I heard you guys talking about it yesterday and Joe described it as rinse and repeat weather, and I think that's a perfect way to put it, unfortunately. It's kind of got a nice big high-pressure system to our south, which is what's influencing most of our weather at the moment. So, look, we're going to be expecting those south to southeasterly winds to stick around really until even the early times of next week, and what they bring is just those showers continuing mostly on and south of the ranges. It looks like they'll be a little bit more scattered over Gippsland, however not too much in terms of what's coming out of them. But, yeah, look, some cloudy conditions continuing for the south, and then those really sunny and clear skies continuing for the northern parts as well. And our temperatures kind of remaining in those mid to high teens and early 20s across the next few days once again. And then in the early mornings as well, in those south to southeasterly winds with that big high pressure ridge, they drop off quite, and become quite calm, particularly in the morning period. So we're looking at some widespread fog and some frost around in the northeast as well. So, I mean, there's not much going on, but again, there is kind of, little micro things happening across the state.
Yeah, we've got frost warnings now. That's starting to make its way into the thing. I've got a frost warning in Northern Country, North Central, Northeast for tomorrow. Is that right?
We absolutely do. Yeah. So those places, kind of just, if you can go from even across our border to Deniliquin, down to Shepparton, and then all the way across to Corryong, and then up into the Alpine region. Those places are expecting frost tomorrow morning. But yeah, look, those light winds. We've got some clear skies, so they. Probably going to be a little bit more prominent from now onwards.
More frost from here on in. Stephanie, thank you so much for the update. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks so much. We'll speak to you tomorrow.
Stephanie Miles there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, taking you through the full forecast there. Rinse and repeat. I do like some of these weather terms at the moment we're going through when we're talking about the same kind of weather every day. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 21 to 1, Warwick Long with you on the program. Tony in Beaufort has an interesting thing to say. Hi, Woz. I don't think the issue should be China versus Canada. The issue for me is that it's super funds or sources that can afford a string of losses buying agricultural land. They push land prices well above fair value, and that trickles down and probably is the main reason ag land is beyond reach for many in terms of price. I'm trying to keep up as a poor farmer, but I get a bad few years and I'm done for, says Tony in Beaufort. Tony, interesting thoughts all the same. Thank you very much for that. David in Coleraine, given it is the 1st of May, has a rainfall figure for us for the month, saying Coleraine, April, 14.5 millimetres, 5-year average, 35 millimetres. David, I bet that feels like a really interesting figure when we're talking about wet season rainfall being above 1,000 millimetres in the Victoria River District. Incredible, but thank you all the same for sending that through. Let's talk energy right now, though, on the Country Hour with the federal government today announcing 6 projects have received the green light to conduct detailed studies in the Gippsland offshore wind zone. This means companies can start doing the business of setting up offshore wind projects across the Gippsland coastline area. 6 more are likely to be approved after further consultation as well. The Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, joined Jared Whittaker on ABC Gippsland today to talk through some of those details, including the issue of getting that power through farmland to the grid.
Well, this is the next stage in the Gippsland offshore wind project. As you know, I declared the zone last year and then called for feasibility licences, and today I'm awarding 6 feasibility licences and taking 6 others to the next stage, which really means there'll be 12 projects, which will mean that now these companies proceed to determine exactly that their project is feasible and go through all the necessary works on management plans and do more community consultation and consult with councils and First Nations people and groups about their plans, and then they come back to me and get approval for a commercial licence in a few months' time. So it's a big day. These projects would generate 25 gigawatts of electricity. So to put that in perspective for our listeners, that's about 100 times more than the Gippsland's industrial use every year, which is a lot, and it's more electricity than Victoria generated last year in total. And it'll create these projects, if they all proceed, 15,000 jobs during construction and another 7,500 jobs for Gippsland on a permanent basis, and that's a big reason why we're doing what we're doing as well.
And these 6 projects, who's been successful?
So of the 6, there's a slightly different process because, as you'd imagine, Jared, with more than 30 applications, a lot of them overlapped. And so we had to, that was a very complicated process to sort of pick the best ones and then get them to work out how they wouldn't overlap going forward. So there's 6 that are basically very, very advanced. Their names are High Sea Wind, Gippsland Skies, Blue Mackerel, Cookwood, Brathalung, Orsted Offshore Wind 1, and Star of the South, which is probably the most famous. And then there's 6 others. They're just at a slightly behind them in the process. You now have to do 60 days of consultation, but I have indicated an intention to award them a licence, and they include Iberdrola, Greater Gippsland 2, Navigator North, Orsted Offshore Australia 1, and Kent Offshore Wind, as well as Great Eastern Offshore Wind. And attached to my press release, which will go out a bit later, there's a map of all the different ones and where they are, so listeners can have a look at that. It's not the whole area that's covered that we previously declared, as you would expect. You know, not every square metre of that has a wind farm on it, probably a bit less than half does looking at it, but it's certainly a very good outcome from these licence applications.
When you talk offshore wind in Gippsland, as well as the excitement about jobs, there's some concern about transmission line routes, effects on coastline. Do you expect that to be covered off in the next round of consultation?
Yes. So now the companies get, they all have their own different plans, but now they get very serious. Now that they know that they've made the cut, made the grade, they now get very serious about putting out their plans about where the transmission will come up into the mainland. You know, a lot of them can share infrastructure, so it minimises impact on communities. There's a lot of transmission already in your community, obviously, you know, with all the old coal-fired power stations, a lot of transmission built. So that means, you know, less need to build a new infrastructure, but inevitably, of course, they'll undersea and get to the land, and then they'll come out at different places, and there'll be varying options for undergrounding, for above ground, for connecting to the grid, but there'll be a lot of consultation about that in this next stage.
That's Federal Energy Minister Chris Bowen speaking there. We'll keep an eye on that to see where it goes from here. You can always send us your thoughts as well. If you'd like to email longer thoughts, you can always email countryhour@abc.net.au. Let's talk to fishermen right now, but from a different part of the state. A fisherman from Port Fairy in the state's southwest says he's had enough of fishmongers and is selling his seafood straight to the public from his boat and regional farmers markets. Ken Swasenberg has been fishing for over 50 years, but 2 years ago he began running the Off the Boat Port Fairy shop in a bid to avoid selling to wholesalers who he says weren't paying a fair price for his catch, despite selling onto consumers for a premium. He spoke with Jane McNaughton at the Ballarat Farmers Market over the weekend whilst he was, well, getting rid of the last of the produce.
We've only come here last month, was the first time, and we sold out, and we've nearly sold out again today, so it's been good, real good. The locals love our fresh fish. They want to know, like, we've got pictures of the boat, and it's all caught between Port Fairy, Warrnambool, Portland. Yeah, all this fresh fish. Yeah, King Island scallops off the boats, and it's all fresh. None of it's come from a supermarket or anything, so it's very, very popular.
So tell us a bit about your business. How long have you guys been running for?
Only 2 years. Yeah, because of things are getting harder fishing, that we started, instead of giving to the, going to the market and the middleman getting all the money, we've sort of boosted our profits by just selling it direct to the public.
So when you talk about the market, I'm guessing you're talking about going to somewhere like the supermarkets or...
The fish market in Melbourne. We used to send stuff off to the fish market in Melbourne, you know, with all our fish, but, you know, then the middleman gets all their money, what you're going to catch it, you know, they get the profit in the middle, so we're just cutting the middleman out a fair bit and trying to keep it as cheap as we can.
You said you've been fishing for a long time. So what was the sort of catalyst to make that decision to move away from the markets?
Just the price. Like our fuel's doubled and our bait's tripled to catch all these fish. But the profit in the market, they're still paying you like the supermarkets. They're paying you nothing. Like they'll buy crays off you in the market. They won't pay you more than $50 and yet they sell them for $100, $120. Where we sell them about $89 a kilo normally, $85 a kilo. Yeah.
So you said you've been running this business in this way for about 2 years. Yeah. Any regrets?
No. We're going well. We had one van there. We got two vans. Well, we only were selling off the boat first. Then we brought one van there. We got two vans. And it's getting busier and busier. Yeah, it's good.
One of the other things outside of input costs that you've already mentioned that has been difficult for many people across agricultural sectors has been climate variabilities and the weather. How's that been for you fishing down near Port Fairy?
Oh, we've got to battle the elements all the time. We can have good seasons, bad seasons because of the weather. But we've got everything else coming at us too now. The wind farms, seismic testing, all that stuff's coming at us. So, and the government, their licence fees and everything's going up. It's just getting harder and harder for fishermen to survive.
For people that are unaware of what's happening down around the coast, what have the challenges been for you as a business with those competing interests with the renewable energy proposed for the area?
Well, the seismic testing obviously will kill scallops and it kills scallops and must kill other fish. They're trying to say it doesn't. But if it can kill scallops, it'll kill all your perilous crays and other fish. It must scare the hell out of them. They're like explosions on the bottom of the ocean. And then we've got wind farms coming. They're going to put them out in the water, you know, like 20 miles of wind farms. We don't know how they're going to go. They've got to disturb whales and every other thing. So it's got to, you know, it's got to affect everything, doesn't it? The system. If you're scaring off whales, and you're proving they scare whales off, and if they get lost by all the noise and all the underground electricity, they get their senses go. So it's got to affect a lot of things, the whole ecosystem really.
And have you noticed the reduction in scallops in your catch?
Yeah, well, they killed them. They've proven now scientifically that it kills the scallops. They used to deny it, but now we've got proof that they actually kill them, but they just don't want to talk about it. That's basically it. Yeah. Yeah.
How's this season been overall, and what are you expecting out of the next couple of months?
Oh, well, winter will be quieter. Yeah, that's why we'll get out to the markets and that. But winter's, the weather turns nasty and, all that. It'll be a lot quieter, but we'll just tick on to next summer again.
Ken Swasenberg there, a fisherman with Off the Boat Port Fairy, speaking to Jane McNaughton about no longer selling to wholesalers and selling direct to the public. You're listening to The Country Hour. It is 11 to 1 o'clock. Let's get back on land right now and talk about some grass. Indigo Valley farmers are in the paddock to learn about native grasses and how they could serve as an alternative and an abundant fodder source. A dozen local producers attended a native grass management field day run by the Indigo Creek Landcare Group and Agriculture Victoria. Facilitator Jim Blackney was there, who was talking about how native grasses have a lot of pasture potential, particularly in that region.
A lot of country, particularly hill country in the northeast, is already native grasses. So there's some distinct benefits from looking at them, managing them, and a lot of farmers are actually utilising them as part of their farming system.
And so when we talk about native grasses, what particular species or types are we talking about?
Probably the most common ones we get in the northeast that are sort of fairly high production value are grasses like weaving grass and wallaby grass. They're two species that are quite productive, quite persistent, offer good feed value, and they do respond well to applications of fertiliser and lime. So they're a couple of the key species, but there's quite a lot of different species of native grass that form pastures in our part of the world.
Are they tough to actually identify out in the paddock?
Not really. A lot of people know their grasses already, even if they don't know the names, they know there's different ones. And that's part of our day, is to just sort of step in and show people some of the easy ways you can identify them. So, no, it's not too hard.
You mentioned strategies like using fertiliser and lime. So what other ways can farmers actually manage these grasses for their benefit?
There's a lot in the timing of your grazing. A lot of the native grasses are like summer active, so that's one of the benefits of them. If we get summer rainfall, they can regenerate really quickly. So timing of your grazing, stocking rates, all of those kinds of things can be adjusted. It's a good idea not to let them get too long in rank, for example. So you time your grazing to when you got the production. And that can benefit with your improved pastures too, because you can rest your improved pastures as well.
And when it comes to the actual numbers behind native grasses as fodder versus normal pasture, how do they compare?
Yeah, surprisingly, in terms of protein digestibility, weaving grass and wallaby grass, for example, are actually up there with some of our improved pasture species. So, yeah, they do compare favourably. But it's also that link in terms of your timing and when they're producing fodder, basically, as well. So they're certainly productive at times when sort of some of the improved pastures are not doing so well.
Considering native grass management, is that just for dairy farmers or livestock farmers?
More livestock farmers. Dairying tends to be more intensive. But, for example, some of the hill country dairy farmers will put heifers on. And there's nutrition benefits as well to some of the animals. But it's probably predominantly sheep and cattle in the drier country.
And so, Jim, you're running this native grass management workshop. So is this something that you've been hearing from local farmers? Is it something that has been on their minds from what you've heard?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of farmers out there who have been utilising native pastures for years, and there are people who are wanting to know more. So we've got this input from a science point of view from the Department of Ag, and it's certainly an interest that as a facilitator, people have been talking to me about.
Would you say that it's best to implement these native grass management strategies as part of a wider grazing or weed control program, or is it a standalone set of practices that you can actually apply?
Yeah, it's definitely part of an integrated sort of approach to your farm management. So I guess the first step's knowing what you've got and then building that into your particular objectives for your property and your grazing management. And working out those strategies that fit within that overall picture.
Mid Ovens Landcare Facilitator Jim Blackney speaking there with Faith Tabaluyan. We're about to head to markets here on The Country. A couple of your texts first. Tom Winslow about that report with the fishmonger before. Hi, Warwick. The guy is on the ball regarding the middleman skimming off big profits in just about every aspect of primary production, says Tom as well. Plenty of other texts coming in. We'll get to more of those in just a moment. Right now, let's head off to markets.
$64, $7.50, $60, $60. Thank you.
$2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2, $2
Markets to Markets. Let's go to Lee and Gatha Cattle for our one cattle market today. Brendan Fletcher has those details for you. G'day, Brendan.
G'day, Warwick. There are 1,850 more at 2,200 with all of the regular buyers operating in the dearer market. Quality improved with a better selection of prime cattle influencing today's result. Trade cattle lifted 30 to 45 cents. Grown steers and bullocks improved 10 to 15. Manufacturing steers gained 20. Cows kicked 15 to 30 cents and heavy bulls lifted 30. Veal is sold from 250 to 414. Yearling trade steers 280 to 390. The heifer portion 274 to 372. Ground steers 310 to 358, bullocks 310 to 348, heavy Friesian steers 230 to 278, crossbreds 260 to 318. Most light and medium weight cows 112 to 243, heavyweights 192 to 276, heavy bulls 228 to 295. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's go to the sheep and lamb market reports now. We'll start in Horsham with the sheep there. Graham Palmer, take it away.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lamb supply increased to 6,300, including about 500 merino lambs. Quality was again mostly good, with a mix of heavy fed lambs yarded. The usual buying group, plus some extra processor competition, operated in a firm to slightly dearer market on the lighter weights. $5 ahead easier on the heavy lambs. Need short skin trade lambs, sold to $170, at times making to 700 cents a kilo. Medium and heavy trade lambs sold from 131 to 170. Heavyweight lambs sold from 200 to 226. Merino lambs mostly sold from 91 to 176. Lighter weights from $49 to $76, ranging from 470 to 600 cents. Restockers and feeders paid from 90 to 148 and from $11 to $90 for lighter weights. Sheep numbers increased to 1,850 with a mix of all weights yarded. Sheep sold the stronger demand on the medium and heavy weights, improving $5 to $10 a head in places. Been Graham Palmer at Horsham from LA.
Thank you very much for that, Graham. Lucky last on the run for markets today is the Hamilton Sheep and Lamb Market Report. Chris Agnew has those details. Give them to us, Chris.
Thanks, Warwick. Lamb numbers rose substantially at Hamilton this week, up to 16,500 as well as 10,000 sheep. Quality overall was very good, with a good selection of heavy trade weight lambs in the lead offerings. However, there was a larger tail on offer of smaller, plain conditioned lambs. Most of the processors were present and fully active in a market that was resilient to be firm over most categories. With the exception of the lambs 25 kilos and heavier, they improved $10 to $15 per head in places. Most lambs to the trade making between 650 and 730 cents a kilogram, and the best heavy lambs making up to $239. Light 12 to 16 kg lambs making from 46 to 136. Trade lambs to 18 to 22, $138 to $180. And the 22 to 26s making from $180 to $211. This is an interim report, as there's still 10,000 sheep to be sold. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thank you very much for that, Chris. Just before we go, a couple of your texts coming into the Country Hour right now. Many of you wanting to have your say about Chris Bowen's comments about the offshore energy projects that have been announced for Gippsland. If you want to read more about that, actually, you can head to our website, abc.net.au/rural. There's a story up there. It's on the main page right now. And speaking of that and other stories we've been speaking about this week, the story about the hay destined for King Island farmers that's being delayed because of the port dispute in Victoria, that's up there as well. You can listen back to Caleb Cooper, which we had on the program this week, and also that story on the largest dairy farm in Australia, which is up for grabs as well, which is up for sale, I should say, up for grabs. If you've got millions upon millions of dollars, I suppose it's up for grabs for you too. It's up for sale. You can read about those details all online at the moment, abc.net.au/rural, a whole world of rural news and information for you to read. But on Chris Bowen's comments about the offshore wind farm developments for Gippsland, Terry from Lee and Gatha says, was your stories about the cost of living and the minister just on talking about feasibility studies and consultations for offshore wind farms tie in? Because that's where the cost of living crisis is going. Too many bureaucrats shining seats and flicking emails amongst each other, says Terry, who sees a link between those stories. And also Chris has sent a text to question the jobs when the minister's talking about, well, over 7,000 in permanent jobs due to some wind farm construction so far with Victoria, with already operating wind farms there, nowhere near that amount of permanent employees. Actually, Chris says it's only a handful. I'd have to check that figure. But that is the text that's coming in for Chris on the program today. As I say, you can listen back to that interview wherever you get the Victorian Country Hour podcast. Just search Victorian Country Hour or download the ABC Listen app. From there, you can text and call the program when we're on air as well. We can just listen back. We'd love to get you to do that whenever you want, because you're not always around at midday. You can listen to the program wherever you want. And then you can email me your thoughts, countryhour@abc.net.au. And then when I get in tomorrow, I can read your thoughts on tomorrow's program, which is when I'll join you again. Have a great afternoon. It's 1 o'clock.